Well, it's a great pleasure and honor to welcome Manuel Castells to Cambridge this afternoon as the Humanitas Visiting Professor in Media. In fact, we couldn't have had a more suitable person to occupy this post, because Castells is simply the most interesting and most exciting scholar working on the media in the world today. There's no one else, in my view, who comes even close to him in terms of cutting-edge original thinking on the ways in which our communications environment is changing in the 21st century. Castells is the University Professor and Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication, Technology, and Society at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and among many other things, he's also a founding member of the European Research Council. Hugely well known and influential for his path-breaking work on the social and political implications of the information revolution. The Social Sciences Citation Index ranks him as the fifth most cited scholar in the social sciences in the world today. Now, you might well be skeptical of citation indexes like that, and you have good grounds for being so, but nevertheless, that's a statistic that's hard to ignore. As many of you will know, the work that he's particularly well known for is his famous trilogy on the information age. The first volume called The Rise of the Network Society, the second called The Power of Identity, and the third, The End of Millennium. But he's also well known for his work on cities and for his more recent work on the internet and communication. His most recent book, called Communication Power, which he sometimes calls the fourth volume of his trilogy, is a real tour de force that explores the political consequences of the communications revolution. And he dwells in particular, at some length, on what he calls mass self-communication, a kind of self-generated form of media or communication, which is particularly important in relation to new social movements. And I think we're going to be hearing more about that today. Now, I've had the privilege of participating in a small workshop with Manuel over a number of years. And one of the things I've learned about him in the course of this workshop, apart from the fact that he has a particular fondness for Portuguese fado music, is that he is a very energetic and restless thinker, always moving forward in his work, always starting new research projects, trying to explore the way in which our world is changing today. And we are all going to be the unwitting beneficiaries of this restless intellectual trait of Manuel, in that he is going to be talking to us over the next few lectures about his current research, his ongoing current research, which has to do with the role of new media in social movements and protest movements of various kinds, from the Arab uprisings to the Indignado movement of Spain to the Occupy Wall Street movement and so on. This is very, very topical material. He's going to begin today with a lecture called Communication, Power, and the State in the Network Society, in which he'll lay out the theoretical foundations of his approach. And then over the next two lectures, he'll focus on social movements in the internet age. The lecture tomorrow will also take place at 5 o'clock here, and then the next lecture, the third lecture, will be on Monday at 5 p.m., also here in Mill Lane, though I think it's in a different lecture hall. And then there will be a symposium next Wednesday on communication power in the Network Society in St. John's College from 2 to 5:30, and you're all welcome to come to that. I hope many of you will. You just need to register in advance so we know the numbers. Now, I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone at CRASH for all the hard work they put in to make this possible. Also to thank the Institute for Strategic Dialogue and Lord Weidenfeld for helping to make the funding available for this. And so without further ado, I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming Manuel Castells to Cambridge.
Good evening. It is my privilege to have the possibility of sharing some of my current research with you for the few days. And I want to thank for this, first of all, my friend and colleague, John Thompson, Professor John Thompson, with whom we have been in dialogue over a number of matters for a number of years. And we just concluded together the project he was mentioning, which will be published next spring, on the culture of the economic crisis, because we had been following the economic crisis from the very beginning of this crisis, and will be a volume with the title Aftermath. But if you think this is about the end of the crisis, no. It's the world in a constant crisis. So anyway, this is what we have been doing with John. But that topic and these ideas, I presented in this very room last year, last fall. So today I'm going to work to present something else, something different, which is my own research. For this, I want to thank you for your presence here. I want to thank the university, and I want to thank Crash, and particularly Helga Brandt, who has managed my visit here. And I'm very grateful, and my way of being grateful is to try to do my best in conveying to you in an organized way the kind of thinking and research I have been working on for the last 10 years, which is really has been growingly focused on the issues of communication and power, starting with power rather than with communication, but then rapidly deriving to communication as the heart of the construction of power in our type of society. Today, as John mentioned, I will try to lay out the theoretical framework on which this research is based, and then in the this theoretical framework is both about the formation of power and the formation of counterpower, counterpower being mainly operated by social movements. In fact, the second and third lecture will be on ongoing research on the first materials I had been collecting on a number of social movements from around the world, and will be changing by the minute. I just, this afternoon, I modified my timeline of the Occupy Wall Street for obvious reasons, and I'm not going to make it definitive until Sunday, because we are expecting a very big demonstration tomorrow in New York, from where new things can happen. As a matter of fact, totally unrelated to this invitation by university, next Friday, the 25th, I will be speaking at Occupy London on similar issues. So trying to relate the two worlds, because that's what I am. I ask your patience for today's lecture, because I usually, for me, theory is not a goal in itself. I am different in that sense from many other social scientists, and it's not that I'm critical of anything, just my, for me, theory is a tool. It's a tool. It's not a beautiful, elegant framework, as they try to tell me in my education in Paris. For me, theory is a tool to think the world, and the world in constant transformation. And therefore, I feel somewhat uncomfortable about presenting theory without an immediate empirical reference that can test the theory and throw through the window some of the elements and bring others. So what I'm asking you is to please don't take this as a formal theory, but as a theoretical tool through which to look at some of the problems that we are going to be analyzing. And for you, in your own research, if you can find useful some of these elements, and if not, means that the theory is no good. It's not if it is elegant or not, if it is relevant or not, if it is useful or not. I have a very instrumentalist view of what theory is. And what happens is that the theory I'm going to present has basically two parts. One is on the relationship to the construction of power in society, and the other, the construction of counterpower in society, mainly through social movements and insurgent politics. The part on the counterpower in society. This is what's going to be the two other lectures. I take the liberty for the empirical reference and support and case studies on the construction of power in the communication realm in our society to refer you to my book published a year and a half ago, Communication Power, where all these materials are brought together to support the beginning of a theory of communication and power in our society. Starting from the source of the analysis, my interest throughout my intellectual life has been ultimately on power relationships. When I was doing urban sociology, it was about power in cities. When I was doing globalization, it was about how globalization is shaped by power. When I have been working on technology, it's about how technology shapes and shapes at the same time power, and so on and so on. Why this obsession with power? Very simple, because power relationships are the foundational relationships of society. Because those who are in power build the institutions and shape the values and norms and of societies according to their interests, values and interests. It's not such a thing as a general society or a general interest society. All societies are built on institutions which are built on power relationships. Fortunately, if we could have one natural law of society as equivalent to some of the physics laws, one, and I am not saying it's the only one, but it would be number one law is wherever all societies are based on power relationships, all societies are based on domination, but wherever there is domination, there is resistance to domination. This is the essence of the construction of society. And therefore, wherever there is power, there is counterpower, and institutions are never the expression of pure power of the dominant groups, values, and elites. It's always the result, institutions are always the result of power relationships and counterpower relationships in a process of constant negotiation and replacement of one some interests and values by others through these constant power struggles. So we live out of conflict, we live out of power, and this never ends. Any institution that has been solidified through a system of power relations is immediately challenged by those who are not or do not feel represented in terms of their values, interests, and alternative projects of life. This is the fundamental point that I am trying to make. Power. To make it simple, I just take one mainstream definition of power, because this is not the nominalist business is not my business. I understand power, just for us to understand each other, I understand power to be the relational capacity of a social actor to influence asymmetrically the decisions of other social actors in ways that favor the power actors' will, interests, and values. As simple as that. Nothing new there. Now, power is exercised in many ways, but fundamentally there are two main ways, both in history and in the literature on power in social sciences. It's exercised by means of coercion, the so-called the monopoly of violence school of thought, by the control of the state. By the way, the monopoly of violence, legitimate or not, that's where I differ from Max Weber. Legitimate or not, a fundamental way to enforce power is coercion. You do that or you're going to have a problem. But it's also another tradition and another set of empirical observations throughout history is power is exercised by the construction of meaning, by shaping the discourses through which social actors guide their actions. Let's say, to put it simple, Max Weber and Foucault, but much deeper than that, Machiavelli and Bertrand Russell. Now, power relations are supported by the structures of domination, which is the power that is embedded already in the institutions of society, and particularly in the state. But not only in the state, in the family, for instance, as well. That's what patriarchalism is all about. is a set of values in the institution of the family, which by itself expresses power relationships. So all institutional systems reflect these power relationships as well as the limits to these power relationships, which are constantly negotiated by this historical endless process of domination and counter-domination. But this is elementary, and I apologize for that. It's simply a matter of going in sequence. But the critical departing point for me is that throughout history, communication and information had been fundamental sources of power and counterpower, of domination and social change. And why? Because this is the fundamental battle is always about the minds of the people. It's about how people think. Yes, it can also be, as I said, through violence and coercion, institutionalized violence, or institutionalized possibility of using violence legitimately. But fundamentally, any power that is based only on the possibility of intimidation by coercion is a weak power. It's a weak power. The power that truly is solidly entrenched in society is the power in our minds. Power is in our minds. It's what we believe, or at least what we believe that we should believe, or what we believe we should accept. Resignation is one form of conformity. So it's not only at what we adhere to, but what we decide that we have to accept, because that's the only way around. Most people in the world, in this society, in all societies, are not that happy with the way power is exercised upon them. But most people, in general terms, think that there's no other way around, because the others, the alternatives that they are offered in the market of politics may end up being worse and what to sacrifice for and what to fight for. So it's therefore the critical battle is what happens in our minds. And what happens in our minds depends on the interaction between our neural networks, on which consciousness is based and decision-making takes place, the connection between our networks and the networks of our environment, the natural networks, our relationship to our natural environment, and the networks that bring us ideas, images, messages, meaning the communication networks. So we always interact within ourselves and with whatever comes to us. But these communication networks, of course, work on neural networks and on a brain that comes equipped. But this brain that comes equipped is simply the what happened in the experience, both through the evolution of the species and the evolution of the individual, okay? Which is again dependent on the relationship to natural networks and communication networks. So what ultimately happens in terms of the reproduction or transformation of any socio-political system depends on what happens in this process of construction of meaning. What is important for me? What is important? What I think is important for society? This construction of meaning is absolutely essential. And the key source for the social production of meaning is the process of what I call socialized communication. Communication. What is communication? Again, simple mainstream definition, just for us to understand each other, is the process of sharing meaning through the exchange of information. And socialized communication is simply the one that exists in the public realm, different from interpersonal communication. Therefore, the process, the battle over the human mind is largely played out in the process of socialized communication. And this is particularly so in the network society, the social structure of the information age, which is based upon the workings of communication networks in all domains of social life. Now, if the changes take place, deep changes take place in the process of socialized communication, we could assume and therefore hypothesize and therefore investigate that the transformation of the communication process will affect the transformation of the processes through which power is established and counterpower is exercised. And in the last, let's say, 25 years, has been a dramatic transformation of the communication realm, technological transformation, the digital revolution, organizational transformation, the global local networking, and concentration of ownership and control, at the same time with customization and distributed content to specific audiences. And then institutional deregulation and liberalization. But the fundamental change, bringing together all this, is from a world of the last 50 years dominated by mass communication to a world of what I call mass self-communication, which, to make it clear, internet and wireless. Which kind of meaning mass self-communication, meaning the process of socialized communication in which messages are, instead of being in the world of mass communication, is dominated by messages from one to many with little interactivity. In the process of mass self-communication, is messages from many to many within a constantly interactive hypertext with a strong interactivity, with systemic interactivity, and with the ability of senders to be receivers and receivers to be senders, and therefore a great deal of autonomy of the communication subject over the institutions and organization of communication. I go fast on this because tomorrow, the beginning of the lecture, will be exactly about how this transformation of communication has taken place, because it's directly related to the building of autonomous communication, which is directly related to the kind of social movements in the internet age. So, on the other hand, communication as a realm of construction of power making relates to all the domains of human life, to politics, media politics, that John Thompson has studied in detail, to business, to finance. In every domain of social life where power exists, communication and the transformation of communication in terms of the mass media as well has been fundamental. Just to give one example, today is widely accepted that politics in our age is fundamentally media politics. It's not the politics that happens in the institutional process. All this depends on what happens in the media. But to this I add, and what happens in the autonomous media, including the internet, which have emerged in the last years. But fundamentally, for a long time now, we know that media politics determines politics, and media politics is not whatever kind of politics, a specific kind of politics which relates to symbolic processes of defining content and creating the process of including, excluding people in the communication realm. For instance, it's not so much that the media, by definition, manipulate. Some manipulate, let's say Fox News manipulate. Or you had a guy around here named Murdoch, no? looks like he's hiding, but Murdoch manipulates, and that's many other things. But this is not the most important thing. The most important element in controlling mass communication is not what is said, it is what is not said. Is the exclusion of certain types of information, of ideas, or debates from the realm of socialized communication. And what does not exist in the media does not exist in society, period. Now, the media have changed. Now there is internet, and there are all kinds of things happening in the internet that therefore exist in society as well. You know, you have 100 million videos on YouTube every day. So, and a global audience, you can do that. But in terms of the construction of power in the institutions that we have today, these institutions reflect power relationships that have largely been built over the last 2-3 decades on the mass media world. That's media politics. Therefore, if power relationships are constructed largely in the human mind, and if the construction of meaning in the human mind is primarily dependent on flows of information and images processed in the communication networks, it could be concluded that power resides in the communication networks and in its corporate owners. Yeah, no. Because it's empirically wrong. So any time that you find an attractive, elegant, simple hypothesis, look at what happens in the world. And we have enough evidence to say this is not the case. Murdoch is not the king of England. He would like, but he's not. So therefore, why is empirical wrong? Because while communication networks are certainly the messengers, they are not the message. And the medium is not the message. Sorry, McLuhan, I like you very much, but no. The message is the message. The message is the message. And whoever produces the message is the one who really determines the content of the message, but it has to go then through the communication network, through the media realm. So what we can say, as a tentative hypothesis, is that the media, in the broadest sense, are the space where power is constructed, but not the source of power. So it's very important to know where power is constructed, but it doesn't exhaust the question about the origins of power, the interests of power. The power is constructed in a different way. Which way? Huh, here is the problem. That's where you have to suffer with me for a while, because then we have to go through the tour, because we have to differentiate different types of power in terms of process, to then try to see what is the relationship between these different of types of power and the content of power making. Power is how power is constructed in the network society through networks. But networks, these networks are not solely or even primarily formed around the state. The state continues to be the enforcer of domination in the last resort. And the state is extremely important source of power, but not the only power. And is not the expression of other powers. It's an autonomous power in relationship to other autonomous sources of power, each one of them formed around networks, and all of these connected through a networking logic. Don't worry, at the end, it's a world of networks and networks of networks, but at the end I find humans hiding before this. But let's see which humans and how we find them. I differentiate, and this is purely conceptual, of course, between four distinct forms of power. The only thing I could not avoid from my French training is to play with words. Mm-hmm. So the four types of power are networking power, network power, network power, and network making power. Got it simple, huh? So what is networking power? It's basically gatekeeping power. Gatekeeping power. Networking power refers to the power of the actors and organizations that are included in networks that constitute the core of social life and social activities. Networks which have power over human collectives or individuals who are not included in these networks. It's so simple. It's you are in, you are out. And this is what, for instance, this form of power operates through the process of exclusion-inclusion. There's a wonderful paper published in 2007 in a technical journal by Tong Yang Wilson that analyzes the value of being in a network following the Metcalfe Law, established in 1976 by one of the pioneers of the computing industry, which shows that the value of being in the network increases exponentially. So the more you are in, the bigger the network is, the higher the value of being in the network. So being in the network is absolutely critical because it increases with the number of nodes in the network, the value of each node to be in the network increases. But Tongia and Wilson did an opposite mathematical calculation. The value, the devalued of not being in the network, of exclusion in the network. And guess what? The value of being in the network increases exponentially. But the value of not being in the network increases also exponentially, but at a much higher rate. So like, so what that would be in terms of, so this is connected to a field of network theory, mathematical field, which is gatekeeping theory. What is the processes and the cost under which certain being or not being in networks are is critical, and therefore power is exercised by gatekeeping, saying, haha, you don't come here. You are not in Jesus College. No way. Go there. Go to Oxford. So the value of gatekeeping is a fundamental one. Example, for instance, a very important gatekeeping system in power relationship is electoral laws. Electoral laws. All political systems are based on nicely crafted electoral laws, which are designed to keep out some undesirable options, parties, people, under the condition that you should not be too aware of that, because it's subtle. It's gerrymandering the districts, it's introducing this law, this percentage, introducing the law of don't rider rather than a proportional law. Depends on what? Depends on the specific power relationship that exists in a society at the time the electoral law is established. And depends on what happened throughout history in terms of the battles about the electoral law. We'll see that, but this current Spanish movement is not the crazy one that people try to present. Among other things, they are presenting proposals to reform the electoral law, to make possible certain things that under the current law is not possible. Ask the liberals in Britain about that. Or news. Which are news is determined in the media world by the editors. So what is news depends on what the news organization decides is news or not. It does not depend, ask any professional journalist that tries to say, but look, it's very important, look what happened here. No, this is who is going to be interested in that? No, that's your ideology. No, find me real good news. Well, again, gatekeeping. This is gatekeeping. And there are many forms of doing gatekeeping in every system. So first form of network power is networking power. Networking power is you are in, you are out, a binary logic. As organizations, as codes, as information, as anything. Second form. Network power. So first was networking. This one is network. Network power can be better understood in an interesting conceptualization proposed by David Grewal on his book of The Global Network, which is in fact a theory of globalization from the perspective of network analysis. The thing here is the following. Globalization requires social coordination between multiple network actors. This coordination requires standards, which in my terminology, I like it to call it protocols of communication. You have to communicate. Example, the Washington Consensus. What is and is not in terms of global financial markets? The rules, the standard under which global financial markets work. Now, this form of power is not being in and out. It's being under a certain set of rules. So it's the power of the rules over the power of the ruled. Not the rulers over the ruled, the rules over the ruled. right? So what is crazy in the market, meaning, no, all markets ultimately should be profit-making. For instance, the markets should be entirely liberalized, should be no government regulation, should be no intervention of the regulator. All this was the Washington Consensus. Now the Washington Consensus has led to disaster. But when it was a consensus, meaning that the somebody's, some institutions organized this consensus. Could be other consensus. When social rights are imposed through struggles, there's another consensus, and that becomes a rule. In this particular case, the consensus was unfettered market will drive prosperity. And under this general principle, a number of actors, political, economic, cultural, academics, hugely academics, produce all kind of value system rules that became the protocols of communication. What does it mean, protocols of communication? Well, that in order to communicate, you have to go through that protocol, like in the internet. So in order to invest in the global financial market, you have to follow a certain number of rules. In order to be legitimate, to be in the World Trade Organization, you have to abide by the rules of the World Trade Organization, unless you are powerful enough not to abide and still be there. This is the whole notion of too big to fail, right? So, so there are rules. These rules are bended depending on specific clauses. But the fundamental form of power is the standards, the rules to be accepted once in the network. In this case, power is not exercised by inclusion or exclusion, but by the imposition of the rules of inclusion. If you are in this club, you follow these rules. If you are in the, you are going to be trading in the stock exchange, you have to follow these particular rules. So the network power is the power of the standards or protocols of communication of the network over its components. Although this network power ultimately favors the interests of a specific set of social actors who are at the source of the network formation and of the establishment of the standards. But who has power in the dominant networks? Now, we have dominant networks that have been established with rules of the game. And we have the networking power being in and out of these networks. But within the networks, one, you have dominant networks. Let's say the global financial market, or let's say a particular network of states engaged in the European Union or in NATO. Now, who has power within the networks? This is what I call network power. Why network power? But because power relationships depending on the intra-network relationships, okay? So who has power there? Ultimately, this looks like is the essential question. Well, all these networks is very good, but finally, are institutions, organizations, people, network in one particular network. Now, let's go to the real thing. Who has power there? Because if we know which networks are the dominant over the other networks, and we know who has power within a particular network, we have a hierarchy of networks, a hierarchy of actors within a network. So we go to the essence. We go to the source of power, to go to the bad guys or the good guys, depending on the perspectives. Well, more complicated again. That's why still we have some job in the social sciences. don't simplify too much, because then job market becomes even tighter. Now, the answer could be very simple. If we answer by analyzing the workings of each specific dominant network, there we are solid. We go into one particular network, and you do some work and some empirical work, you can find global financial markets. You can find the usual suspects very quickly. And we can have, ultimately, a global financial market with specific actors, and then the controllers of this power, let's say the rating financial agencies, which have been constructed to enforce the power, whoever are the powers that be in the global financial networks. By the way, Remember, this is not a pure functionality. What the rating agencies do is to follow the rules of this global financial market. We come in a second to what is this global financial market, and say, well, whatever the global financial market says, you should follow. How? I downgrade you, or I grade you. Mathematical equations, well, follow the proceedings in the US Congress. No, opinions. Opinions. They always say, whenever they are asked to make a statement, they only express opinions. Why? Because if they would not express just opinions, they would be liable for billions of dollars for professional misconduct. Because they have systematically been wrong, upgrading and downgrading depending on a specific interest, and not being accountable for it. The only, that was not a rating agency, it was an accounting company. Arthur Andersen was caught by accounting in their own interest and had to disband. But fundamentally, financial agencies simply express the power relationships in the global financial market. And the global financial market, we can follow and we can find, trace back to a number of actors and institutions with a specific networks of interest. It's not only one or two or ten. It's a network of intertwined interests. For instance, very few people, other than the specialized in finance, in the people at large in the world, knew how crucial was one institution, AIG, that was the insurer of the largest banks in the world. And that collapsed. And AIG, in 2008, was intervened by the US government that owned at that time 80% of the shares, and now it's about 65%. So it's actually a US government intervening company, but it was working directly in the global financial markets with a network of other financial institutions, which together, that network together, had collectively the power, but not individually, as a network. That's why I had called sometimes the global financial market an automaton, because it's a logic that goes beyond the control of any particular entity. Or let's take the state military power, another network, different. Well, the state military power depends on who has the technological capacity to create a new form of warfare and has enough resources and political will to spend most of their money in doing so. Of course, the case is the United States, and then from there you take other networks connected to the US military power. In that network, that military, we can identify a hierarchy. We know that the Israelis have power over any Arab contender. We know that the United States decentralizes power, but in fact, ultimately, military power is concentrated in the United States. We know that China would last about 1 week in a conventional warfare with the United States. So we know all this. So we can identify. But we can go one after another through all these networks, specific networks of power, network power in different domains of human activity. And all this ultimately would be leading to some individual sources of power in each one of the networks. But none would show a unified entity. None would show one dominant network over the others, because they are all interdependent. Military power does not mean that you have the power over the financial market. In fact, it's the contrary. The more you invest in military power, the more you create a financial crisis. Financial power does not determine what happens in the political world. It can shape. But what really happened in the political world is much more media power, and therefore power of the media businesses. Media business depend on financial business, certainly, but at the same time, they have to do a little thing, which is actually sell. because it depends on how they shape the audience, how they transform citizens into audience, which is the big transformation there. So cultural power. Cultural power is not necessarily what reflects directly the power in other networks. It reflects some general values, some ideologies. Science and knowledge and technology power is a different network. It's a different network. It's not true that the military dominate high technology in Silicon Valley. Not anymore. It was in the 60s, but has not been the case for a long time. So all in all, empirically, we found a diversity of sources of power. There is not a unified power elite, not empirically. But at the same time, we don't have simply, as in pluralist theory, a set of independent networks and independent actors in different dimensions. No, we have networks between them. We have networks between each one of these major vertical networks of power has networks with the other networks of power. So network power is to some extent either an empirical, has an empirical answer. Depend on the network, tell me the network and I will tell you which, who or what has power there. Or an untenable proposition if we look for a unified single source of power. Because the most crucial form of power is a different, follows a different process. Network making power. Who and for what makes the network? Any network. And this network making power functions on two basic mechanisms. One is the ability to form networks and to program and reprogram the networks in terms of the goals assigned to the network. A political system is a network which is programmed by those who have power at each particular moment. A financial network, the same. A cultural network, the same. So whoever has the capacity in one particular moment to design a network that fulfills its, his, her goals and values, organizes the network and programs the network. Once a network is programmed, once the program is already embedded into the function of the network reproduces itself, reconfigures itself, is a very efficient, flexible, adaptable structure once the network is already has its own program. Same biology to some extent. Once you have the program in the system, then the system goes. But secondly, since networks of power are multiple, there is a second mechanism which is crucial, which is the ability to connect between different networks. The ability to adapt the different values and goals. The ability to create synergies between different networks, like between the financial network and the media network, and the media network and the political network, and the cultural network and the financial network. Are the science and technology network and the financial network. How universities work in relationship to the financial network. Now, universities are not simply the expression of financial networks, financial power. They're not. But at the same time, these days could not survive without the financial corporations that are behind universities. But at the same time, universities have to project certain images, a certain culture that goes to the cultural networks. So you see, it's a different set of networks, but then the critical mechanism is how you switch these networks with each other. So you program networks, you reprogram networks, and you switch networks at not the same actors, not the same institutions, not the same organizations. So in a world in which networks organize power relationships, the fundamental form of power, but not the only one, is network making power. How you make a network. And you make a network by programming the network and reprogramming the network and being able to set up programs of switching with other networks which are critical for the function of the network. And that's why, I know it's too abstract, but those who are, if we have to identify who holds power in this society, mainly two categories of people. Programmers, those who program the network. Switchers, those who are the critical switching point between networks. Now, who are these things? They are made of humans, certainly. And some robots, but no, they're made of humans. No computers, no structures. No, they are agencies, to be clear. It's not about the structure. They are agencies. But these agencies, which are, of course, made of humans, what else? They are not themselves just individuals, just specific persons or actors. They are networks of actors. Not actor network, no Bruno Latour, no actor network, network actor. The network becomes the actor. Not the actor builds a network. The network becomes the actor. And this network is made of a number of individuals, persons, organizations, institutions that organize the connection. Example, in terms of programming a powerful network which has the capacity to integrate all the others. An example which, fortunately, is history, Berlusconi. Berlusconi programming politics, programming finance, programming media, and all in a single entity. Now, but the entity is not Berlusconi himself. It was a series of people and institutions and organizations, including the Catholic Church at the time, and including the Italian Socialist Party at the time, so one actor in the political system. It really did not come from outside the political system. Came fundamentally from the Socialist Party through real estate speculation to finance the Socialist Party, and the main idea was to build Berlusconi to destroy what was left from the Italian Communist Party. And the networks were programmed in all these strategies. So it's not simply the Italian people being stupid and re-electing Berlusconi for 15 years. It was a very sophisticated political engineering, financial engineering, media engineering that created the system, created the network. Switching. Your great citizen, Rupert Murdoch, who was not only himself. Murdoch, I wrote an article, empirical article on him 2 years ago, showing Murdoch as an expression of switching power, but not himself. His News Corp and his network of many other things, including spending the weekend himself and his daughter in the same town than Cameron and his family, etc., for years. So all these connections were the one particular network that switcher that connected financial, media, and political network in Britain. In the United States, the Murdoch switches were different. He gave money to the Democrats and ideology to the Republicans. If you look at the list, as I have done, of donors in the United States, Democrats appear very prominently for a long time already in the donations of News Corp. But of course, Fox News is entirely a propaganda machine against the Democrats. So, therefore, no ideology there. It's strictly, personally, it's different. But in terms of the switching role depends on the ability to generate the possibilities of connecting different networks. Now, so each one of the networks has its specific sorts of programming and switching. And they're different. But they all work, they all have one common trend. This common trend is that they all are based on ideational materials, ideas, visions, projects, and ultimately frames. All this is ultimately mental. What these programs are, they are not computer programs. They are computerized often, but they generate frames. They generate visions of the world. They generate ideas. They generate basic evidence such as market equal prosperity, state equal bureaucracy. So these are frames. Lakoff is right in that sense. The only thing is that frames don't appear like this. They come from somewhere, and the political and economic production of frames, that is, of what we think and how we think, it's a fundamental part of understanding the logic of frames. So if where these frames come from the communication realm, and therefore from the multimedia communication networks. Ultimately, this is how all this is generated and processed in our minds. It's not that, yes, we are born with some frames, but the actual operational frames that come to us depend on how we live. And this how we live is we live in a communication environment. So ultimately, all the materials, all these ideational materials, all these visions, all these frames, are ultimately produced, processed, and distributed through the multimedia networks of communication. Therefore, the control or the influence on the networks of communication and the ability to create an effective process of communication and persuasion along the lines that favor the projects of the programmers, these are the key assets in the ability to program each network. In other words, the process of communication in society and the organizations and networks that enact this process of communication are the key fields where programming projects are formed, where constituencies are built for these projects. They are ultimately the fields of power in the network society. And the second mechanism, as we know, is the switchers. But again, for the switchers to work, they have to have compatible cultural materials. You have to have a connection between the cultural production of what is success in society and the consumption society, for instance, that relates to the ability of the financial world to make sure that you borrow, because if you don't borrow, they cannot be in the business of selling money, which is what they do, basically. They create debt to sell it to others. Okay? So if they do so, you have to be convinced at one point that life is to consume. Instead of consuming life, you consume yourself. In order to be able to consume yourself, then you have to borrow. So you are not convinced that you need all this stuff, all these goodies that you need to borrow to pay for, you will not borrow. So the first operation, and this has been studied by psychologists and sociologists for a long time in the consumption society, if you are not convinced mentally, you will not borrow, therefore the financial system stops. So ultimately, the programmers and switchers are the actors and the networks of actors that, because of their position, hold network-making power, which is the paramount form of power. And the key for network-making power is the capacity to program the communication networks or to control the switches between the state, capital, and communication networks. All right, but where is power in all this? We lost power in the whole analysis. Well, power is fundamentally made through, not by, but through communication networks. And these networks operate in forms that we know in terms of making this power. But whose power these networks process? If the meta programmers are the owners of the multimedia business, are they the power elite of society? Some people would argue that we are in a society characterized by the shift from, in terms of power, from the ownership of the means of production to the ownership of the means of communication. There's some formulation in that end. That's elegant as a hypothesis. Again, it's not true. The owners of global multimedia corporate networks are among the power holders, but because they do program the decisive network, the meta network of communication networks, the network that processes the cultural materials with which we feel, think, live, submit, and fight. The relationship to social actors is easy to identify. They transform humans into audience. by selling us the images of our lives. We don't have our lives. We have the images of our life. And therefore, the corporate networks and the owners of the corporate network, they do have physical owners. I know a few of them live in Los Angeles. They achieve their interests, money-making, influence-making, by designing the content of our culture according to their corporate strategies. But first, this does not necessarily mean that they impose their values upon us, because something called the active audience, and now increasingly the creative audience, in which there is an interaction. They send us some stuff, and we process that stuff, and we'll see. But they try. That's it. Again, power is not necessarily an imposition. Power is a relationship. It's always a relationship. It's not a thing. Power is a relationship. So they try to impose power through cultural production, and we adopt, resist, interact alternatively in cultural terms. But even the corporate networks, ultimately, what they do depends on what it sells. If it doesn't sell, it doesn't work, because ultimately they are themselves dependent on the financial networks. So if they are not profitable, they will be cut off. And if they are, and to be profitable, they have to sell. And to have to sell, they have to at least convince or at least negotiate with the audience. If they are plain stupid, only under the conditions of mass stupidity, they can go on. So yes, there is some hypothesis that in Italy that was the case for a while. More than stupidity was pure sexism. It was all about women and dress. So basically, that was the thing. But this has a limit. The limit in Italy concretely was women. Women, at one point, said, come on, we had to finish this guy because we are being reduced to the subhuman level in which we were time ago. No way. And the movement of women started to change the tidal wave in Italy. So, but ultimately, the effectiveness of media depends on their adaptation to the cultural patterns and the change of minds and the evolution, be it now major television series in which gayness is prominently presented and it's a nice thing and it's a tender thing and the stupid people are those who don't understand it and so on and so on. Women roles, children, Nickelodeon, the kids' nation is diverse. Children are of all colors. They are autonomous. They think autonomously vis-a-vis their parents. This is a cultural revolution. They do it because they suddenly decided that the children should be this way? No, because if they don't do that, the young mothers, unless young mothers, or mothers who want to look like young mothers, shut it off. They're not going to take their children into a world of traditional family, because then their children will undermine them in their struggle within the family. So all this sensitivity, after all, comes from the fundamental rule of the media, which is you have to sell, you have to convince, you have to influence, you have to find a connection with this interaction. Why? Because they are dependent ultimately from the financial network. And then, of course, because the people who actually do the media, the journalists, the designers, are real people who are in society and they're exposed to cultural change. And as soon as they see the opportunity to say, look, we have to really make sure that the mother can be a mother and good mother and work and have her own life, etc., has to be in this series, because otherwise we are not going to be able to connect to the people. Okay, do it. So it's an interaction between the human agency and the structural interest that we are saying. But at the same time, the range of power relations is much broader. So financial networks, yes, are interacting closely with the media networks, but then they themselves, to some extent, depend on political power relationships. Regulation. Regulation is fundamental for the multimedia networks. It's fundamental for the financial network. Why global financial markets emerge was not simply because at one point capitalism developed by itself. No. Thatcher and Reagan did it, to start with. And then many others followed. And then a flurry of academics demonstrated that that's where the way the world should work. No government interference, free markets, great prosperity. By the way, little footnote. Result, the major capitalist success is led by a communist state, China. Global financial markets unfettered and unregulated, total collapse in 2008, and the one that is emerging and coming, unfortunately, but coming now. All right? So the regulators deregulated. It's not like suddenly the sky opened up and markets started. No, markets always had been there. The problem is how much the markets, how much regulation, which kind of regulation, under which conditions, and that interaction depended on political processes. So political networks created the condition for a transformation of the power of the financial network that created the condition for the transformation of power of the media networks, which created the condition for media politics, scandal politics, what Professor Thompson has been writing about and what I have, after him, developed in the last years. That is the ability to provide a platform for political process to emerge is what we call today media politics, which is not just politics. It's a different kind of politics, and which is not just media. It's a particular language, a political language translated into the media code. That interface between media and politics is what we call media politics. And media politics is what determines the access to state institutions and therefore to political power in societies around the world. By the way, including authoritarian countries with no freedom of the press, such as China. Any time that the Beijing clique wants to get on the Shanghai clique, they find a way to find one of the corruption cases in the mayor of Shanghai. And then this is publicized. There's a media campaign. And then the power relationships change. They cannot just do it like that. They have to do it through changing the mind of the people, including in authoritarian states. So the programs embedded in political institutions themselves exercise network power over citizens and political actors. The judiciary exercise networking power, meaning gatekeeping power, to political competition. And the political system as a whole is based on network power within the system distributed at different levels of the relationship. And ultimately, political network making power is the power to define policies in the political realm that depends on winning the competition to access to political office and obtaining support or at least resignation from citizens, and media politics is the fundamental mechanism in this particular process. So, summing up, I'm making my argument, in fact, threefold. First, power is multidimensional and is constructed around networks programmed in each domain of human activity according to the interests and values of empowered actors. But all networks of power, all, exercise their power by influencing the human mind, predominantly, although not solely, through multimedia networks of mass communication. Thus, communication networks are the fundamental fields of power making in society. And the transformation of communication from mass communication to mass self-communication increases the autonomy of social actors and therefore the processing of power relationships in society at large. Second, networks of power in various domains of human activity are networked among themselves. They do not merge. Instead, they engage in strategies of partnership and competition, practicing cooperation and competition simultaneously, forming ad hoc networks on specific projects, and changing partners depending on their interests in each context and each moment in time. Switching is critical in this process. Third, the network of power constructed around the state and the political system does play a fundamental role in the overall networking of power. This is, one, because the stable operation of the system and The reproduction of power relationships in every network ultimately depend on the coordinating and regulatory functions of the state and political system, as we have seen at the moment of the collapse of the financial networks in 2008 and 2011. Second, because it is via the state that different forms of exercising power in distinct social spheres relate to the capacity, institutional capacity, to monopolize violence as the capacity to enforce power in the last resort. And so, while communication networks process the construction of meaning on which power ultimately relies, the state continues to be what I call the default network for the proper functioning of all other power networks, as the Occupy Wall Street people tonight. And so, this apparently abstract characterization of power holding in the network society has, in fact, very direct empirical references. Networks are formed by actors in the networking arrangement, but who these actors are and what their networks are is a matter of a specific configuration of networks in each particular context and in each particular process. So what I'm saying is I'm not declaring who has power under which condition, but how to look for power, where power can be identified, under which conditions, which are the mechanisms, which are the connections. Therefore, as a tool to guide empirical research of power in each network and each context, rather than a new formal theory of power, which can be easily constructed by equally easily dismissed. So, but I do have one major hypothesis, is the centrality of communication networks to implement the power-making process of any network. And I am suggesting that switching different networks is a fundamental source of power. Who does what, how, where, and why, through this multi-pronged networking strategy, is a matter for investigation, not for formal theorization. And therefore, if power is exercised by programming and switching networks, counterpower, the deliberate attempt to change power relationship, is enacted by reprogramming networks around alternative interests and values, and or by disrupting the dominant switches while switching networks of resistance and social change, which will be the subject matter of lectures 2 and 3. But ultimately, the fundamental hypothesis is the struggle of power. The power, the construction and deconstruction of power relationship is, in fact, the struggle that has always been the same throughout history, the struggle to free our minds. Thank you for your interest.